It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. I rarely do Wingnut Week in Review outside of Fridays, but wow, so much wingnuttery to get to, and it's only Wednesday. So maybe we're going to get to Wingnut Week in Review on Wednesdays. Maybe that's the thing. And I'll tell you, what sent me off the edge today, thinking the wingnuts have really gone too far, is yesterday you had the Senate filibuster. You had them filibuster the Paycheck Fairness Act. And this is one of those things where you go, hold on, the Paycheck Fairness Act? Who could possibly be against fairness in wages? You know, people being paid equal for the same amount of work. And look, as a union guy, I'm used to that. That's been my entire career because our wages are laid out in a contract. Everyone knows what they're being paid, and it doesn't matter who's doing the job. They get paid the same. That is why I believe every worker should have a union contract, especially women. I mean, to be honest, you've been getting the short end of the stick for way too long. And here, the Senate Republicans, all of them unanimously saying, no, you should make 85 cents of what a dollar of what a man makes. If you're black, you should make less than that. If you're Latino, you should make even less than that. And it wasn't bad enough that all 50 Republicans in the Senate, mind you, all millionaires, never mind that all of them were united in their, no, we like unequal wages. But Mitch McConnell took it a little bit further and said that the Paycheck Fairness Act was, quote, the left's radical parade of legislative proposals. Radical parade. You know, wanting people to be paid for the work that they do. Somehow now in Trumplandia, run by people like Mitch McConnell, that's radical. It's radical to want to get paid a fair day's wage for a fair day's work. Radical. And then, you know, you just see all the piling on of the crazy beyond that, because if it's not bad enough, this is what the Republicans have done. And it got me thinking. I saw the religious zealot. And understand, I believe religious extremism is not just destroying this country, but destroying this planet. These kooks who are way off out onto the extremes, some point we got to deal with this. But Marjorie Taylor Greene, who, again, I think it was a huge mistake to not keep her on the Labor and Education Committee and busy attempting to do something close to nothing. But she's got plenty of time now to do podcasts and do all these interviews. And I guess she was doing a recent interview where she came right out and said, look, I don't believe in so-called science. I don't believe in evolution. I believe in God. And, you know, she goes on to this whole virus thing about how, you know, Fauci's Dr. Frankenstein and how he should be charged for, you know, who knows what. Because, you know, the virus is a bioweapon, and just all this kind of, you know, stuff banging around between her ears that really doesn't land anywhere. It's just kind of, you know, banging around and then, you know, spews out of her mouth. This is scary stuff because she's sitting in Congress. Now, granted, she doesn't have anything to do. She's kind of like wallpaper, just there. And, you know, to be honest, the crazy is apparent. But I look at this stuff, and you've got people are sending huge amounts of money and listening to. Because I've heard this from a number of places, and people that I thought kind of had their heads screwed somewhere close to normal. This conspiracy theory that this was a bioweapon that the Chinese put out. And I'm not saying that this wasn't something that they were working on. They got hit by it too. But this idea that you know, this cabal is in on it, you know, Fauci's part of the head of it, it's kind of crazy. And then you throw on top of it a former, you know, general, Michael Flynn, coming out and saying that Dr. Fauci is the Dr. Christian Zell, the Nazi doctor, who evidently used to remove gold teeth from the Jews at Auschwitz. That's what we've come to. This is now being said out loud and on the right cheered. I mean, this is literally over the edge. And remember, these are the people who they're in positions and had been in positions of power. Is this the best that we've got? Is this who we are? Is this who we've become? It's scary and just frightening in so many ways. And as we're rewriting a whole bunch of stuff, because now these conspiracy folks, look, they do great work in taking the kernel, the small seed of reality, and blowing it up into something just wow. And you give them credit for, because look, they would be great writers. These would be, you know, great mind altering kind of novels, but they're selling it off as God's honest truth, because again, everything they do steeped in religion. And you look at the fact that, you know, we saw with our own eyes what happened on January 6th. And they're attempting to even rewrite what we saw happen in front of our eyes. Now, again, another one of those wingnut kind of crazy things. I look at Mo Brooks, the Republican representative from Alabama. Eric Swalwell, the Democratic representative from California, he has sued a bunch of people, Brooks being among them. Donald Trump, a bunch of people for what happened on January 6th and the damages. It's going to go nowhere. You can't sue members of Congress. Good luck on that. But you know, you just, like everybody else, you just take the subpoena, you take the papers, and you move on with it. Well, Mo Brooks tried to play a cat and mouse game, tried to get out of it. In fact, it made Swalwell go back and get the judge to issue an extension to give him opportunity to hire a private investigator to go out and serve Mo Brooks with these papers. And eventually the private investigator found his wife, handed him off, and sent Mo Brooks into a tizzy. In fact, you know, crazy, you know, going into these tweets, you know, saying that they snuck into the house, accosted his wife, all this stuff. And that he was going to seek an arrest warrant and, you know, criminal trespass and all this stuff. So, you know, you go, okay, you know, I can't walk into your garage to hand to a legal job, but you're okay with people invading our Capitol and defecating on the floor. It's not like someone walked into Mo Brooks' front door and on the kitchen floor took a giant dump. That didn't happen. Handed the wife a piece of paper. That's not accosting her. That's going, here, give this to your husband. You've been served. But, you know, again, we have this crazy kind of just, you know, these people who, you know, I wouldn't allow to coordinate a trip to the zoo, let alone to run our public policy and to run our country. Because at the end of all this, and this is the sad reality, as we're eating our own, as we're dividing ourselves up, slicing each other up into subdivisions and parts over here and pitting each other against one another, the Chinese are growing stronger. And really, I mean, it's almost over at this point. I mean, there's part of me that goes, you know, it's just a matter of time before we end up at their behest, because we're so divided. And just idiot, just at the level of idiocy, you go, how is it possible we're this screwed up? And you go, it can't get any worse, can it? Well, then I move over to Louis Go-Go Gohmert. And whenever you see Louis's name in the news, it's always something fun. And I wanted to play, you know, Louis's clip, because I find it quite amusing. Whenever Louis Go-Go Gohmert has something to say, it's got to be fun. So Louis had he was having a Zoom meeting and with the folks from the Bureau of Land Management. And, well, this is what Louis had to say.
And I understand from what's been testified to the Forest Service and the BLM, you want very much to work on the issue of climate change. I was informed by the immediate past director of NASA that they have found that the moon's orbit is changing slightly, and so is the Earth's orbit around the sun. We know there's been significant solar flare activity. And so is there anything that the National Forest Service or BLM can do to change the course of the moon's orbit or the Earth's orbit around the sun? Obviously, that would have profound effects on our climate.
I would have to follow up with you on that one, Mr. Gohmert.
Now, the look on her face is priceless, to be honest with you. The look on this poor woman's face is like, oh, my God, you didn't just ask me if we in the Forest Service could do something to change the moon and the sun's orbit. And how you didn't just ask us, the people who are worried about forest fires and things like that, to literally change the orbit of Earth around the sun and the moon around. You didn't really just ask that. And the answer is, yeah, you just heard. And I had to play that because nobody would have believed me that that Louis would go that route. Nobody would believe that. But when you hear it yourself and you go, oh, my God, he just said that. Now, it's almost as funny. No, it's funnier, actually. No, it's right there in that level of stupidity, to be honest. A number of years ago, you had a Democrat who was worried that, we would move military things into Hawaii. We'd, bring tanks and stuff into Hawaii. And he was worried about the island tipping over. It's that kind of level of idiocy. And you go, these are people, sorry, you won the popularity contest, but oh my God, get out. Do we not have somewhat reasonable, somewhat functional, somewhat intelligent people that actually care about humanity? I guess not. Which leads me to my favorite story. My favorite story is of this anti-vaxxer woman. I believe she's a doctor. Her name's Sherry Tenpenny. I would go half a penny best. But evidently, she has testified in front of the Ohio legislature to prohibit, Ohio businesses and schools from mandating vaccines. And look, we can have that debate. We can have that conversation. She comes out, and I love the one thing she said. She said she's been studying this. What was it? She spent like 10,000 hours researching this. Look, you can't keep your mouth open long enough in front of the YouTube screen long enough to do 10,000 hours. Because if you consider it, and someone did the math, there's only been about 11,000 hours since Ohio declared a state of emergency. So somehow she studied for 10 of the 11,000 hours that Ohio had gone through the pandemic. So she knows everything. And I'm going, is there really 10,000 hours worth of anti-vax research out there other than you're just making stuff up? And that brings me to the really making stuff up part. Because according to her, and again, you'll remember right from the beginning, there was the fear that Bill Gates was going to inject you with whatever it is that they want, the RFID chip, the little kernel of rice that they'll be able to follow you around with. This is what was going to happen. They're all going to be able to control us with the vaccine. And look, there are some fairly prominent doctors who have bought into this stuff, because enough that, the Ohio Republican Party said, yes, please come testify. Please come share your idiocy. Please come share just how off the beaten path. And I got to be honest, if I'm a patient of Dr. Tenpenny, I'm looking elsewhere and quickly. Because according to Dr. Tenpenny, evidently, because of the vaccine, and this has been such a great meme on Twitter and on social media, because of the vaccine, And somehow, because of 5G, somehow there's a reaction that now people who have been vaccinated, they're magnetic. You know, they walk by the kitchen table and spoons just stick to them. They can stick forks on their forehead. They can, you know, I guess if you got enough vaccine, you walk by something steel, you just got stuck to it and can't get off. And some of the memes on social media have been pretty funny. The fact that, the one guy with the spoons all over his entire body was fairly great. Now, I remember when I was a kid, they used to play the stick things to your forehead thing. I could never figure out how to do it. But now, evidently, thanks to the vaccine, we're all walking magnets. And it's the combination. And now she's done the research, understand, that the combination of vaccine, and it's all of them. It's not just one or the other. It's all of them. And the 5G that we're so far behind on, that is basically crap, that has magnetized us. And you go, but Rick, come on. You're just one kind of kooky person who's, you know, off on the fringe. It's, you know, she's not the norm. Honestly and truthfully, if you saw the email I get from people talking about these vaccines and how, you know, this is, you know, a global conspiracy and, you know, how, you know, it's all of the, you know, the machines are going to take over, and it all somehow recently it's turned around this 5G. The 5G technology now is what they're going to use to control us. Because understand, 5G technology is about how robots and computers are going to interact. It's about how smart cars will make sure that they don't smash into each other. It's how we're going to put the automated vehicles on the rails. It's how computers are going to interact. It's how AI is going to rule the world at some point. And now it's their belief that they've turned us into robots. This would be a great Ray Bradbury book. It'd be a great sci-fi novel. I'm struggling with a doctor who's going to come out with this kind of nonsense. But I'd love to hear your thoughts. Please send me your conspiracies. Maybe I'll use it here on the program. I do love to hear it. Going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. More American than workers standing up. And the union gives a voice to win. On The Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1937. That was the day Consumers Power Company employees near Flint, Michigan, shut off generators and turbines at the Zilwaukee Power Plant. 2,000 workers organizing with the Public Utilities Union under the direction of the UAW effectively cut off power to everything except hospitals, city sanitation plants, and dairies. The company's office workers joined the walkout, hanging a banner across the Flint District office building that read, "Quit stalling." The company had dragged its heels on an agreement promising union recognition, a closed shop, wage increases, and an end to 24-hour scheduling of troubleshooters. The strike cut power to an estimated 165,000 Flint residents. It also forced the closing of 6 area General Motors plants and impacted industrial centers like Saginaw and Bay City. The strike ended a temporary truce that Governor Frank Murphy had forced between the UAW and Consumers Power, which ended a several-hour-long walkout at the power plant earlier in the month. The strike paralyzed 13 counties across the Saginaw Valley. When news of the second strike hit, Murphy put the National Guard on standby. He snapped orders at UAW leader Homer Martin to get those lights back on. "I will not stand by and see those people in darkness tonight." Top union officials insisted the strike was unauthorized and that a tentative settlement had been reached. But workers demanded to see the actual terms of the agreement before they agreed to go back to work. The workers ratified the contract. Tensions continued. Governor Murphy demanded that the county sheriff organize a special force to prevent future utility strikes, while the UAW vowed to curb wildcat strikes through investigation and discipline. Labor History in 2, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
remember, I think it was back in April, actually, when U.S. intelligence officials came out and said, you know, China is going to be a massive security threat. In fact, the word that they used was unparalleled. They are an unparalleled security threat because, well, you know, they've got our manufacturing base. They've figured out how to infiltrate probably all of our computers because we need the chips from them and all of the stuff that's come over here. And they're getting much more, well, much more aggressive with their military. And this is kind of one of these moments where, is it too late already? I'm kind of concerned that it is, especially how weird and screwed up we are right now. But yesterday was a good day. The Senate actually, in a bipartisan way, said we need to do something on the Chinese, on the China front. We need to do something about our manufacturing. And they finally passed a piece of legislation that is going to help. It's called the U.S. Innovation and Competition Act, focused on, hey, making us more competitive. The Chinese not happy. And here to share some thoughts on why the Chinese aren't happy, I've asked our good friend Emily Delaburie to come talk with us. Emily is the co-founder of the Horizon Advisory, their website, horizonadvisory.org. Emily, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
So let's get right to the piece of legislation. Yesterday, 68-32 vote. You had 19 Republicans come along and say, yeah, we got to do something on the China front. We've got to invest in U.S. manufacturing of semiconductors, of rare earth materials. We got to figure out how to deal with. We need a manufacturing base. I'll tell you, kind of stunned.
I mean, the issue that there's bipartisan agreement on is China. This is fantastic, right? Because it means that suddenly this is something that's tractable, that there's going to be every incentive to work on. And also, like, that the reality isn't going away anytime soon, that we're in a structural competition and a determinative competition with China. And also now there's political pressure on both sides to keep towing this line. I'm not going to pretend I think this bill is sufficient or perfect, but the fact that it exists and that both sides are willing to put their weight behind something like this, that's fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, the numbers are, you know, it's a pretty sizable bill. But when you start talking about $50 billion over a decade, it sounds like a big number, but it's really not. When you talk about, we've basically lost our manufacturing capability of semiconductors. And then you think about how important they are to our daily lives. I mean, I look around my studio and, you know, there's probably hundreds, if not a thousand of them right here where I'm at.
Yeah, and actually, this is a question I have for you. When you look at this bill, do you think that there's enough for the manufacturing of semiconductors, for example, or manufacturing broadly, as opposed to like basic research and development into them?
No, I don't think there's enough for manufacturing. We have spent the last two decades allowing corporate America to move our manufacturing base overseas for pure greed, for pure profit, for cheap labor and lax environmental regulations, which I've said for years is heroin to CEOs. They can't get enough of that fix. But now we're starting to look at it as a number of us have been saying over the years, this is a national security risk. The reason we were able to win World War II is we were able to compete by building ourselves into it. The battlefront of this generation is internet, it's technology, it's cybersecurity, it's all of this stuff, and we are woefully behind.
Yeah, that makes sense. And like, that's my big concern about this bill, is that we're continuing to put our resources into like the early stage research and development and not the applications and not the industry and the industrial capacity, which to my mind risks just like further fueling a system that's not working instead of changing it.
Right.
However, you know, that doesn't change the fact that this bill in its own right is a great step.
No, I mean, for me, and maybe you'll come along, we're at a Manhattan Project kind of moment. We are so far behind, and this is such an important issue. Semiconductors and information technology and cybersecurity, we should be spending massively on it. Not just, you know, $50 billion is a lot of money, but it's not near enough.
Yes. And I'd like for the next, you know, the next tranche of money that goes into this, like the next step is to say, okay, you know, because what this does, right, is kind of just like adds more resources to what already exists in terms of like the stages we focus on. I want the next version of this to say, okay, those test beds, those research and development test beds we gave like initial sums to in this first bill, those are going to get more funding, because what matters is actually building the stuff. And instead of giving money to like developing new technologies for critical minerals, we're going to put money into the actual mining and production of those minerals, and processing of them. And same in semiconductors. Like, I want us with every step of putting the resources we need into this to move farther down the industry chain, so that we're actually able to capture the applications, which is where we're losing the race, not just, you know, continue to win at the basic innovation, but have that be stolen by China, and have China win the race that matters.
No, and make sure that we have the capability of getting the factors of production as well. The fact that we're reliant on the Chinese for rare earth minerals and things that we need to do this is kind of frightening, because at the end of the day, and I know the Chinese came out today and said, well, you know, what they did yesterday was Cold War thinking and, you know, zero sum thinking. But they've been looking at this in a war footing for a very long time. It's only us who, no, we're friends. We're partners. As long as we're giving them things, yeah, we're buddies. But the second we say, no, I'm not giving you my lunch money anymore, now it's Cold War era thinking.
Yes, exactly. And just going to the early state, the first beat there, it doesn't really matter if we know how to make the production factors. If we're the best at knowing how to produce them, if we're not the ones producing them. And I think we're starting to realize that, but that's, the switch that's going to flip. I think that's how that phrase works. And that's what I'm looking forward to next.
Now, I've had these conversations for years now on how the Chinese use these state-owned corporations they just funnel tons of money into it. And they basically can sell finished product and develop things for even cheaper than we can buy the raw materials for, simply to take over the market and to dominate whatever sector that they've targeted. For me, this is kind of that moment where in a bipartisan way, you have politicians, again, on both sides of the aisle, 19 Republicans came along. And put aside their ideology of free markets and all of that nonsense, to say, look, we've got to make a stand. I think this is an incredible and an important moment.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I'd add, like, the industries they focus on are the industries that matter. Like, they identified the right candidates. And I'll leave aside my issues with how precisely resources were allocated, but the bill talks about standards, which are incredibly important, technical standards, and China's effort to game them. It does talk about protecting intellectual property and protecting US research and development. And it acknowledges the role of manufacturing, even if, there's a lot of work left. Yes, like, everything this bill stands for is precisely right.
It's just not enough in my view. Now, one of the things they do talk about is something we've talked about a number of times. This 5G technology, the next generation of internet, whatever, we're woefully behind. And if you listen to the woman in Ohio, it's the 5G technology and the vaccine who have made us all magnetic, which is kind of funny in a certain way. But the sad reality is, and who knows, maybe the Chinese have figured out a way to put the vaccine in us and make it, maybe she's right and we just don't know it.
Yeah, in that case, we're due for a rude awakening, but we can't do anything about it. And I mean, I do think that, like, the 5G point, though, that gets to, and I'm going to keep hammering on this, but like, what has to come next? This bill isn't going to be enough for making us competitive on 5G. What's going to make us competitive on 5G is investing in large scale infrastructure so that is built at, the 5G necessary telecommunications networks are built out across the country. And also competing for the international technical standards in 5G and all the way across the industry chain. And that's something that doesn't come from this bill. It comes from an infrastructure bill, and it comes from a manufacturing focus bill. And it comes from understanding that supply chains are broad and that standards are a competitive domain.
No, I think, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was saying, but we've made a first step. I'll be happy about that for now. Let's hope we make the next five steps we need.
No, and then that's it. You've got to make the next five steps because, I think if anything, the pandemic, again, has awakened some folks. I've had people who were the China cheerleaders for a while now going, well, maybe you were right, kind of the head down. Maybe they're not our allies in all of this. Maybe they are our competitors. And look, we don't have to take a war kind of verbiage They're aggressive competitors, even though I say, look, we're in the middle of a war. It's a new generation kind of war. It's a new type of war, but we're still at war with these people. And the disinformation that they're throwing out. And the fact, you know, they had a bunch of op-eds dropped today. They had a bunch of stuff coming out saying, no, we're not that bad. Please don't make us the invisible enemy, I think the one guy said. No, you're not invisible. We know exactly who you are.
And it's just so amazing. Like, their propaganda machine, their disinformation machine is so good. Because domestically, for decades, as you said, they've been saying this is a war. You know, the U.S. is our adversary. We're going to overtake the U.S. We're going to reshape the global system, what have you. But they're so good at turning on a dime the second we do anything competitive and saying, oh, my goodness, you're going to cause confrontation. It's not the Cold War. Don't make us your adversary. And that, they're right, because that targets a really clear sensitivity within U.S. thinking. We're so bad at competing. We so hate confrontation that we see that. And the immediate reaction is to take a step back and say, oh, my goodness, we have to just de-escalate. We shouldn't cause a war.
Yeah.
But the thing is, like, we're already in one. So it's either we surrender or we realize that we got to compete and their propaganda is nonsense.
No, I'm right there with you. So let me ask you this, because, you know, and this is, you know, to bring it back home. I'm looking around and I'm feeling despair. I'm almost feeling to the point where it's almost hopeless. When you look at how divided we are as a country, where we can't seem to agree on very much, and we're literally eating ourselves from within. This China issue could be something that we can rally around and unite around. Maybe we'll see. But I have this kind of despair in that I don't know. I don't know that we're up to the challenge. In this moment in history, we're not my grandparents' generation who rose to their challenge. I don't know that we can.
And it's really remarkable because the China issue has all the ingredients to cause us to come together on this subject. Of course, like, their propaganda machine gets in the way. But for example, everything that polarizes people in the US about the US is worse in China. Whether you're coming at it from the question of human rights or environmental degradation or rule of law abuses, or from the other direction, in terms of the national security angle, you point at China and they're a whole lot worse. But we're so inclined to turn inside, to turn inwardly and hate the US or hate ourselves or hate our neighbor, that we don't realize how bad this threat actually is, and how terrible their authoritarian regime and what a threat to ours it constitutes.
Yeah, and to highlight your point on their propaganda machine, there was a letter to the editor in the New York Times, I'm sure, or the Los Angeles Times. I'm sure you saw this, by a guy named Zhang Ping. He is the consul general of the People's Republic of China there in Los Angeles. And he was talking about the LA Times had come out and said that they supported the boycott of products made with cotton that was produced by the Uyghurs and people who they said were put into the forced labor. And they came out and said, he claims that the Times embraced the rhetoric of, how did he put it, the rhetoric of genocide and forced labor. And he said there's never been genocide in Xinjiang, I guess, or forced labor in the region's cotton fields or any other sector. It just never happened. We don't do genocide. We don't do forced labor. We're good people. We know that this is false.
Yeah. And also, let's just talk about that asymmetry there. Can you imagine a Chinese media outlet running commentary from somebody in the U.S. talking about the genocide in Xinjiang? It just wouldn't happen because they protect that. And yet, we're going to run that letter from the editor because freedom of press, because all voices should be out there. And so they're able to force their narrative into any conversation and give it outsized presence, which then lets it catch on and makes people think that they can reasonably argue or suggest that maybe the genocide in Xinjiang doesn't exist. It does.
Yeah, there's no question. But, and I go back to where I said a minute ago. I have some despair about us being able to rise to this moment's challenge. And look, I don't have a problem with the Chinese people. I have a problem with the Chinese government. I have a problem with their leaders. I have a problem with their mercantilist policies. I have a problem with all that. But with the Chinese people, I want them to lead good lives. I want them to be treated well. But I'm telling you, I have some hope because I saw a story today that the 20-somethings in China are saying, We're not going the 9-9-12 route, or what is it, the 9-9-6 route. You work 9 in the morning and 9 at night, 12 hours a day, 6 days a week. We're not doing this. We're not working ourselves to death. And they're doing this lying flat thing that's going on in protest. And this gives me some hope that maybe there's an opportunity to change things there at some point. Or am I being too optimistic?
I mean, okay, let's acknowledge, first of all, that I'm never going to be the optimist in the group.
Okay.
That said, I mean, I think that there are, and I'm always inclined to dismiss those things that we say are inevitable and inevitably going to support, you know, the U.S. moving forward, because I don't want us to take those things for granted. But I think, A, it's certainly valid that no matter what effort China makes fully to repress information, it will not be repressed. And you know, people, young people in China are going to receive a message about the rest of the world. That still leaves it up to, in large part, us and allies and partners to make that narrative a compelling one, not to make it so easy to paint, you know, us as a fallen empire with shootings at every corner and you know, economic prospects dwindling, but rather as a place of freedom and self-expression that should appeal to a 20-something. So, you know, we need to work on that. But the idea that information is going to reach there and that can change the hearts and minds of young people in China, that's a really valid one. The other, you know, what you just said prompted in my head as well. We have this conventional wisdom that the U.S. private sector is going to save us. And, you know, there are many reasons to say that's not going to happen. But a couple of things this week have been, you know, have made me a little more optimistic on that front. Peloton's building a factory in the U.S. First Solar is building a factory in Ohio to make, you know, solar panels or inputs for solar panels. These are really good things. And maybe the narrative about China and about the need to produce in America actually is having an impact on the private sector. And that, you know, that there, like just those two things strike me as tremendous progress and a sign that maybe hope is not entirely lost.
Or they're seeing that there's a lot of money to be made off of what's coming. And it's purely about the greed that got us into this mess because corporate America put us here. I fear the idea that corporate America is going to get us out. But Emily, I appreciate the time. I appreciate your input and your expertise. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Good stuff. As always, our good friend Emily Delabrurier. Make sure you check out their website, horizonadvisory.org. We'll get some links out on how you can take a look at that. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1954. That was the day that marked the public downfall of Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy. Senator McCarthy had become the public face of anti-communist hysteria during the Cold War. He used his position as senator to make wild accusations against alleged communists in the U.S. government. He ruined careers and ramped up public fears of a menacing communist threat. Public officials, labor leaders, university presidents, and Hollywood stars and directors all became potential targets of the Red Scare. The hysteria took a particular toll on the labor movement. In 1946, Congress overrode President Harry Truman's veto and passed the Taft-Hartley Act. The act required that all union leaders sign an affidavit that they were not communists. Those with ties to the Communist Party, or those who simply refused to sign the loyalty pledge on principle, faced expulsion from the labor movement. The communist purges ripped the labor movement apart, expelling some of the most progressive and radical leaders. Senator McCarthy was the public face of the anti-red witch hunts. But some in the public began to question his bullying tactics. Then the senator made an unfounded claim that the army had been infiltrated by communists. For 2 months, the American public watched as Senator McCarthy conducted televised hearings into the United States Army. Joseph Welch served as the chief legal counsel for the army. Senator McCarthy accused another lawyer of Welch's firm of having communist ties. Angered, Welch asked,
"Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency?"
Many in the public watched the testimony and wondered the same thing. McCarthy's popularity and power was finally checked.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, as we've talked about a couple of times over the last several months, the Pennsylvania State System of Higher Education, they are the folks who oversee our 14 publicly owned universities across Pennsylvania, what I have called the jewel of Pennsylvania, a way for us to educate middle-class, working-class kids, give them an opportunity to get an affordable education and to do better. You know, the idea is education is your way to move up, to move forward. We should make it accessible. We should make it affordable. But the state system seems to have this idea that what we need to do is we need to take those 14 and dwindle them down to simply, what, 6, 8? By getting rid of, four of them. They've got 6 schools that they're going to consolidate into 2 separate ones. They're going to take what looks like Bloomsburg. I guess this is the proposal. They're going to take Bloomsburg University, Lock Haven University, and Mansfield University, and they're going to combine all of them in the north part of the state of Pennsylvania. And then Edinburgh, Clarion, and California University of Pennsylvania, they're going to combine them in the west. So you're going to take 6 and make 2. And somehow they think that this is going to be helpful to our kids and the next generation. I think it's a horrible mistake. I think we should be funding these things at the proper level, and we should make sure that they're there for generations to come. And here to share some thoughts on this bad idea and what happened yesterday during their forum, I've asked Jamie Martin to come talk with us. She's the president of APSCUF, the Association of Pennsylvania State faculty and I always forget that. Jamie, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you, Rick. It's really always really good to be with you.
Now, my mind just went completely blank for a second, and I'm going, you know, the Association of Pennsylvania State College University of Faculty, right?
That's correct. Yes.
All right, I got it. Yes, I passed this test. Maybe I need to go back to school. Walk me through this bad idea, because you know I've read a couple of stories about it. We've talked a couple of times. I'm looking at this, going, we're going to take 6 universities that are really important to the places that they are. They're important drivers of jobs and of the economy, but more importantly, they're geographically placed in places where we can pull people into those areas and get them good educations. Now we're going to destroy all that. It seems short-sighted. It seems wrong to me.
Yeah, well, and again, thanks for highlighting this issue for us. This is something we've been concerned about since the process began. So you're right. They're talking about 3 in the West, 3 in the North, and consolidating those into 2. We have a lot of questions. The students have a lot of questions. We didn't see answers in the plans that were introduced. And so we've been moving forward as APSCUF, holding some open forums so that people can speak up, share their ideas, share their views about this. And what we are hearing are the same kinds of concerns we've had. So let me lay out some of those. You know, each of these universities is over 150 years old. So they've been in those communities for a long period of time and have evolved into our, you know, posse system and into the universities. The major concerns that we have, it's clear from the plan that it's not going to save money. So it's going to cost more than it would save. It seems very clear that students are going to be forced into a hybrid model of courses. And so we have students, you know, already saying, I don't like what I'm experiencing right now over this last 2 semesters.
Right.
I don't want to have to be in a situation where I'm forced into taking hybrid classes to complete my major. It's, you know, they're just all of those questions. We have questions about accreditation, questions about the NCAA and whether or not they'll allow athletic teams at all 6 universities. So there are a lot of questions that we don't have answers to, and yet they're planning to move this process, making the most significant changes in the state system's history in 9 months. So from start to finish, this began in October, and the final vote is slated for mid-July.
Wow.
So what we keep hearing is, you know, let's pump the brakes. Let's get some answers. get students the opportunity to voice their opinions when they're back on campus in the fall.
Yeah, let's not pump the brakes. Let's slam the damn brakes on. Hold on a second. It's bad enough that they've got this bad idea, but then ram it through like this, it seems really, really short-sighted to me because, you know, as you said, these are long-time institutions in these communities. I think the community should have some say in it because, after all, they are owned by the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. They are owned by we the people. We should have at least some input into it.
Yes, and you know, so it was, we had some events of our own, open forums, but the state system had the first two of the four events today. And we were hearing comments like, I didn't even know that this was occurring. I didn't know the consolidation was occurring. I didn't know that this forum was happening. I didn't know how to log in. I just found out 15 minutes ago. You know, a lot of students saying, a lot of my friends aren't aware of this. They have a lot of questions. They don't know how to get those answered. So you're right. You know, these universities are critically important. They were designed to help, you know, working class kids, right? Kids from working class families attain a higher education, and to be doing this kind of major consolidation in such a short period of time without having answers seems short-sighted. And, you know, the questions that we have is, what if this goes badly?
Yeah, I mean, there's no going back to that. I mean, once you've done this, there's no going back from it. And you know, as you were speaking, I was remembering back 2010 when Governor Corbett was slashing the higher education budget, and you guys and a number of the universities and students put together a rally on the Capitol steps. And I was waiting to speak at the rally, and there was a kid I met who was standing in the background, who told me the story that, you know, he was the first in his family who was going to college. He said his grandfather had wanted to go, couldn't afford it, went to work in the mill, doing whatever it is they did. But, you know, he wanted to make sure that the father went. You know, the father began going, ended up being sent to Vietnam. And, you know, before you know it, you know, life happens. He didn't get to complete his college education. This kid was going to be the first who was going to be able to complete a degree. He was a senior at the time. And he said, problem is if I don't get to do this, if I don't get to finish my degree, there's no mill for me to go back to. And this is what we've done to this next generation, is we've taken the jobs that you fell back on, and you've said, this is your only shot. Go into debt, skin in the game, all of that nonsense. And now we're going to make it that much harder for that kid who was struggling to get by as things were. We're going to make it that much harder on him to complete his degree. It's insane to me.
Right. And, you know, and you're always spot on with all of these points that you're making. You know, so the cuts, we go back to the massive cuts we've suffered, we haven't recovered. And that's really I think that's where the fight should be, right? That's what we should be all pulling together, faculty, staff, students, and the state system, and really going in and advocating for additional funding for the state system of higher education. That's what we need. Instead, we're going to say we don't have the funding, so let's consolidate these universities and make it, you know, for that young man, not only potentially more expensive, but now being forced into hybrid courses, having to take, you know, a hybrid course while he's at Bloomsburg, zooming into a Mansfield classroom or vice versa.
No, it's crazy. And for me, you know, when I think about this stuff, I think about those kids that I met. And, you know, I've had the opportunity to talk to people who have gone and work in our state system. These are dedicated people who want to do what's best for the kids and for our state. And for me, if we lose this, you know, Pennsylvania, as you know, is one of those states that, you know, the younger generation is leaving. And that's been happening for a while. I say we make sure that we have an opportunity to educate them here, keep them here, and get them jobs here. So for me, I look at this and our legislature has let us down. You know, I go back to something one of your predecessors told me years ago. He said, you know, back, you know, when I was a younger man, the tuition was something like Two-thirds of it was picked up by tax dollars. About a third of it was picked up by tuition the students had to pay. Today, that number, and I'm sure you've updated it even better, but today that number is the students are picking up three-quarters of it, and the tax base is picking up just a quarter of it. So we've seen a massive redistribution of wealth and a massive redistribution of cost onto the people who can least afford it, those working-class families who are struggling to get by as is.
Right. And so, you know, we are still 47th or 48th in the nation in funding for public higher education. It has driven up the cost of tuition for our students. They're leaving with massive student loan debts that they're, you know, probably postponing buying cars, buying homes, doing all of those kinds of things so that they can pay off their debt. We were happy to see that there is another bill introduced to consider the Nellie Bly Scholarship Program that would provide scholarships for students in the state system of higher education. That was something that came today. So, you know, any way we can find funding to help offset the cost for students, we should be doing. But to get back to the consolidation plan, I think at the very least, it needs to be slowed down so that we can have a thoughtful, reflective examination of some of these outstanding questions.
Right, I'm with you. So how do we do that? I mean, you know, on the funding question, I love the idea of giving people scholarships and helping where you can. But at the end of the day, we just need to fund these universities. We need to make sure that their base funding is there so that we're not raising tuitions on everyone, as we had done in generations past. You know, I have people who are my age and older going, well, you know, I had to pay my way through school. No, not at this level. And this is, I think, the issue that's it's most important for people to understand. What we've done is we've completely saddled a generation with massive student loan debt and then said, oh, well, you know, you got to have skin in the game. Nonsense. We need to be funding this stuff. Now, back to how do we stop this? Because at some point, we got to figure out how to stop this. Does this come with mass rallies? Does this come with general strikes? What do we see coming out of this?
Well, I guess I will say this. There are the two sessions today, one at 8:30, one at one at 8 o'clock, one at 4:30. Probably 50 people spoke. One person seemed to be supportive of the plan and the rest were opposed. There are two more sessions tomorrow. And, you know, the chairman of the Board of Governors is there. Chancellor Greenstein was there and others. I hope they are truly listening. I hope they're taking to heart what they're hearing. And if that happens, then I would suspect that a vote would be delayed. Because if they could hear all of what's being said from the heart, you know, from a father who said, I have two kids in high school that I was hoping they would go to one of these schools. You know, a woman who was a college student in the 60s talking about her experiences. If they can listen to all of that and then turn around, dismiss it and still vote on July 15th to move this plan forward, I don't know what else could stop it.
Ultimately, does this come down to a political decision, though? I mean, the reality is, you know, it sounds to me, and you can obviously you're the one in the room with these people. It sounds to me like they got a fetish. They've got something on the brain and they're going through with it come hell or high water.
I guess there are times I try to be an optimist and I am hopeful that maybe they are going to hear that all of these comments are going to resonate and they'll say, you know what, there are a lot of questions and we do need to think about this. But I don't know, Rick. I keep saying, you know, I've heard a lot of people say we have to do something. I think we need to make sure that something that we are doing is the right thing.
Right.
And the way to do that is to slow down. Let's get the questions asked, have them answered, let the students be heard, let the students be heard on this. And then if it turns out that it's a great plan, then yay.
So who appoints these people on this board? Is this something that Governor Wolf can get involved in? Because at some point, there's got to be some break that says too far, too fast.
There are some political appointments on the Board of Governors. The governor has appointees, both House and Senate, Democrat, Republican caucuses have appointees, and then there are others. It's about a 20-member board. There's student members. This vote in July would require a two-thirds vote of the board to move it forward into the implementation phase. So I hope the individuals on the Board of Governors, I hope that they're listening too. You know, APSCUF can make these points. AFSCME has been making similar points. But if we're willing to move forward on this kind of a significant, massive change to the state system without hearing from our students, that would be, I think that would be shameful. And they especially deserve a voice. And the best way to make that happen is when they're back on campuses in the fall, let's go and have them in an auditorium where we can sit down and say, here's what this means. Ask us your questions and let us answer those.
Yeah, because here's my fear above and beyond all of this. They get this consolidation plan done. They cut off four universities. They go and, hey, a couple years down the road, because this is what usually happens. A couple years down the road, well, you know, we need another cut. Well, let's sell off this. Let's hock off that. Let's sell the furniture. Let's sell the curtains. Let's just, until you have nothing left. That's my fear. And look, I got a 12-year-old daughter who's dying to go to the school that my wife went to. Wants to go to her alma mater so she can go there too. I want that school to be there by the time that she gets around to being college age. How do we get in touch with the people who are going to vote on this? For me, they're obviously the key. Is there a way to communicate with them? What are you suggesting we do?
All right. So you can go to the PASHE website and they have a form that you can fill out and submit any kind of written comments that you might want to have. We're having additional forms. I think if you go to the APSCUF site, there's probably a link from our site directly to the PASHE site. We're trying to, I'm not sure if their emails are available, but certainly it's going to be those 20 members that will make the decision about whether or not this moves forward. And that vote, I think, is slated for July 15th. So those would be the individuals. Certainly, you know, Governor Wolf, I think he has areas where he can submit comments as well. So those, I mean, that will be the group that will make that decision.
I'm of the mindset we go knocking on some folks' doors, take a couple hundred people, go knock on people's doors and say, hey, this is serious. There's no hiding behind email. There's no hiding behind public comments. We know who you are. This is how we, the people, want you to vote. But then again, that's just me.
Yes. Well, if I can leave you just with one short story that came out at one of the hearings today. It was a colleague from Bloomsburg University who said that a student of hers said something to this. It was to this effect. I don't understand why students from wealthy families can go to the university, whatever university, private university, and have fully face-to-face classes, and for a poor student like me, I'm not worth that, right? I have to be into a situation where I'm going to have to take a lot of my classes online. That doesn't seem fair.
Nope.
And I would have to agree with that young student's assessment. That doesn't seem fair.
I agree. So we call the PASHE people early. We call them often, have our voices heard. We'll get links out on social media, and we'll make a push to help, because we want to make sure that those universities are there for future generations. Jamie, I appreciate you taking time for us. As always, good stuff.
Thanks. Thank you, Rick. Have a good evening.
Good stuff, Jamie Martin. Make sure you check out their website, appscuff.org. We'll get links out on social media, how you can take a look at that. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Hello, I'm David Philman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing, so is your labor union. We are AFSCME.
We make-